1917, unyielding pacifist though he was, Mr. Sinclair had advocated America's wholehearted prosecution of the Great War. Foreseeing that it would unquestionably exterminate German militarism and thus forever end all wars. Most of the Morgan partners, though they may have shuddered a little at association with Upton Sinclair, saw that however much income they themselves might have to sacrifice, only Winthrop could start the business recovery. While Bishop Manning of New York City pointed out that Winthrop always spoke reverently of the church and its shepherds, whereas Walt Trowbridge went horseback riding every Sabbath morning and had never been known to telegraph any female relative on Mother's Day. On the other hand, the Saturday Evening Post enraged the small shopkeepers by calling Winthrop a demagogue, and the New York Times, once independent Democrat, was anti-Winthrop. But most of the religious periodicals announced that with a saint like Bishop Prang for backer, Winthrop must have been called of God. Even Europe joined in, with the most modest friendliness, explaining that they wished not to intrude on American domestic politics, but only to express personal admiration for that great Western advocate of peace and prosperity, Berzelius Winthrop. There came representatives of certain foreign powers, lecturing throughout the land. General Balbo, so popular here because of his leadership of the flight from Italy to Chicago in 1933. A scholar who, though he now lived in Germany and was an inspiration to all patriotic leaders of German recovery, yet had graduated from Harvard University and had been the most popular piano player in his class. Namely, Dr. Ernst Putzi Hanstengel. And Great Britain's lion of diplomacy, the Gladstone of the 1930s, the handsome and gracious Lord Lossiemouth, who, as Prime Minister, had been known as the Right Honorable Ramsay MacDonald, P.C. All three of them were expensively entertained by the wives of manufacturers, and they persuaded many millionaires who, in the refinement of wealth, had considered Buzz vulgar, that actually he was the world's one hope of efficient international commerce. Father Coughlin took one look at all the candidates and indignantly retired to his cell. Mrs. Adelaide Targimich, who would surely have written to the friends she had made at the Rotary Club dinner in Fort Beulah, if she could only have remembered the name of the town, was a considerable figure in the campaign. She explained to women voters how kind it was of Senator Winthrop to let them go on voting so far, and she sang, "Berzelius Windrip's Gone to Wash," an average of 11 times a day. Buzz himself, Bishop Prang, Senator Porkwood, the fearless liberal and friend of labor and the farmers, and Colonel Osceola Luthorne, the editor, though their prime task was reaching millions by radio, also, in a 40-day train trip, traveled over 27,000 miles through every state in the Union on the scarlet and silver, ebony-paneled, silk-upholstered, streamlined, diesel-engined, rubber-padded, air-conditioned, aluminum Forgotten Men special. It had a private bar that was forgotten by none save the bishop. The train fares were the generous gift of the combined railways. Over 600 speeches were discharged, ranging from 8-minute hellos delivered to the crowds gathered at stations, to 2-hour fulminations in auditoriums and fairgrounds. Buzz was present at every speech, usually starring, but sometimes so hoarse that he could only wave his hand and croak, "Howdy, folks," while he was spelled by Prang, Porkwood, Colonel Luthorne, or such volunteers from his regiment of secretaries, doctoral consulting specialists in history and economics, cooks, bartenders, and barbers, as could be lured away from playing craps with the accompanying reporters, photographers, sound recorders, and broadcasters. Tiefer of the United Press has estimated that Buzz thus appeared personally before more than 2 million persons. Meanwhile, almost daily hurtling by aeroplane between Washington and Buzz's home, Lee Saracen supervised dozens of telephone girls and scores of girl stenographers, who answered thousands of daily telephone calls and letters and telegrams and cables and boxes containing poisoned candy. Buzz himself had made the rule that all these girls must be pretty, reasonable, thoroughly skilled, and related to people with political influence. For Saracen, it must be said that in this bedlam of public relations, he never once used contact as a transitive verb. The Honorable Perley Beecroft, vice presidential candidate, specialized on the conventions of fraternal orders, religious denominations, insurance agents, and traveling men. Colonel Dewey Hake, who had nominated Buzz at Cleveland, had an assignment unique in campaigning, one of Saracen's slickest inventions. Hake spoke for Windrip not in the most frequented, most obvious places, but at places so unusual that his appearance there made news. And Saracen and Hake saw to it that there were nimble chroniclers present to get that news. Flying in his own plane, covering 1,000 miles a day, he spoke to 9 astonished miners whom he caught in a copper mine a mile below the surface, while 39 photographers snapped the 9. He spoke from a motorboat to a stilled fishing fleet during a fog in Gloucester Harbor. He spoke from the steps of the sub-treasury at noon on Wall Street. He spoke to the aviators and ground crew at Shushan Airport, New Orleans. And even the flyers were ribald only for the first 5 minutes, till he had described Buzz Windrip's gallant but ludicrous efforts to learn to fly. He spoke to state policemen, to stamp collectors, players of chess in secret clubs, and steeplejacks at work. He spoke in breweries, hospitals, magazine offices, cathedrals, crossroad churches 40 by 30, prisons, lunatic asylums, nightclubs. Till the art editors began to send photographers the memo, "For Pete's sake, no more photos, Cunnel Hake, spieling in sporting houses and hoosegow." Yet went on using the pictures. For Colonel Dewey Hake was a figure as sharp-lighted, almost, as Buzz Windrip himself. Son of a decayed Tennessee family, with one Confederate general grandfather and one a Dewey of Vermont, he had picked cotton, become a youthful telegraph operator, worked his way through the University of Arkansas and the University of Missouri Law School, settled as a lawyer in a Wyoming village and then in Oregon, and during the war, he was in 1936 but 44 years old, served in France as captain of infantry with credit. Returned to America, he had been elected to Congress and become a colonel in the militia. He studied military history. He learned to fly, to box, to fence. He was a ramrod-like figure, yet had a fairly amiable smile. He was liked equally by disciplinary army officers of high rank and by such roughnecks as Mr. Shad Ledoux, the Caliban of Doremus Jessup. Hake brought to Buzz's fold the very picaroons who had most snickered at Bishop Prang's solemnity. All this while, Hector McGoblin, the cultured doctor and burly boxing fan, co-author with Saracen of the campaign anthem "Bring Out the Old-Time Musket," was specializing in the inspiration of college professors, associations of high school teachers, professional baseball teams, training camps of pugilists, medical meetings, summer schools in which well-known authors taught the art of writing to earnest aspirants who could never learn to write, golf tournaments, and all such cultural congresses. But the pugilistic Dr. McGoblin came nearer to danger than any other campaigner. During a meeting in Alabama where he had satisfactorily proved that no Negro with less than 25% white blood can ever rise to the cultural level of a patent medicine salesman, the meeting was raided, the costly residence section of the whites was raided, by a band of colored people headed by a Negro who had been a corporal on the Western Front in 1918. McGoblin and the town were saved by the eloquence of a colored clergyman. Truly, as Bishop Prang said, the apostles of Senator Windrip were now preaching his message unto all manner of men, even unto the heathen. But what Doremus Jessup said to Buck Titus and Father Perifix was, "This is revolution in terms of Rotary." Chapter 11. When I was a kid, one time I had an old maid teacher that used to tell me, "Buzz, you're the thickest-headed dunce in school." But I noticed that she told me this a whole lot oftener than she used to tell the other kids how smart they were, and I came to be the most talked-about scholar in the whole township. The United States Senate isn't so different, and I want to thank a lot of stuffed shirts for their remarks about yours truly. 0 hour, Berzelius Windrip. But there were certain of the heathen who did not heed those heralds, Prang and Windrip and Hake and Dr. McGoblin. Walt Trowbridge conducted his campaign as placidly as though he were certain to win. He did not spare himself, but he did not moan over the forgotten men. He'd been one himself as a youngster and didn't think it was so bad. Nor become hysterical at a private bar in a scarlet and silver special train. Quietly, steadfastly, speaking on the radio and in a few great halls, he explained that he did advocate an enormously improved distribution of wealth, but that it must be achieved by steady digging and not by dynamite that would destroy more than it excavated. He wasn't particularly thrilling. Economics rarely are, except when they have been dramatized by a bishop, staged and lighted by a Saracen, and passionately played by a Buzz Windrip with rapier and blue satin tights. For the campaign, the communists had brightly brought out their sacrificial candidates. In fact, all 7 of the current communist parties had. Since, if they all stuck together, they might entice 900,000 votes, they had avoided such bourgeois grossness by enthusiastic schisms, and their creeds now included the party, the majority party, the leftist party, the Trotsky party, the Christian Communist Party, the Workers' Party, and, less baldly named, something called the American Nationalist Patriotic Cooperative Fabian Post-Marxian Communist Party. It sounded like the names of royalty, but was otherwise dissimilar. But these radical excursions were not very significant compared with the new Jeffersonian Party, suddenly fathered by Franklin D. Roosevelt. 48 hours after the nomination of Windrip at Cleveland, President Roosevelt had issued his defiance. Senator Windrip, he asserted, had been chosen not by the brains and hearts of genuine Democrats, but by their temporarily crazed emotions. He would no more support Windrip because he claimed to be a Democrat than he would support Jimmy Walker. Yet, he said, he could not vote for the Republican Party, the party of entrenched special privilege, however much in the past 3 years he had appreciated the loyalty, the honesty, the intelligence of Senator Walt Trowbridge. Roosevelt made it clear that his Jeffersonian or true Democratic faction was not a third party in the sense that it was to be permanent. It was to vanish as soon as honest and coolly thinking men got control again of the old organization. Buzz Windrip aroused mirth by dubbing it the Bullmouse Party. But President Roosevelt was joined by almost all the liberal members of Congress, Democratic or Republican, who had not followed Walt Trowbridge, by Norman Thomas and the Socialists who had not turned communist, by Governors Floyd Olson and Olin Johnston, and by Mayor LaGuardia. The conspicuous fault of the Jeffersonian Party, like the personal fault of Senator Trowbridge, was that it represented integrity and reason. In a year when the electorate hungered for frisky emotions, for the peppery sensations associated usually not with monetary systems and taxation rates, but with baptism by immersion in the creek, young love under the elms, straight whiskey, angelic orchestras heard soaring down from the full moon, Fear of death when an automobile teeters above a canyon, thirst in a desert and quenching it with spring water. All the primitive sensations which they thought they found in the screaming of Buzz Windrip. Far from the hot-lighted ballrooms where all these crimson-tuniced bandmasters shrill squabbled as to which should lead for the moment the tremendous spiritual jazz. Far off in the cool hills, a little man named Doremus Jessup, who wasn't even a bass drummer but only a citizen editor, wondered in confusion what he should do to be saved. He wanted to follow Roosevelt and the Jeffersonian party, partly for admiration of the man, partly for the pleasure of shocking the ingrown republicanism of Vermont. But he could not believe that the Jeffersonians would have a chance. He did believe that, for all the mothball odor of many of his associates, Walt Trowbridge was a valiant and competent man. And night and day Doremus bounced up and down Beulah Valley campaigning for Trowbridge. Out of his very confusion there came into his writing a desperate sureness which surprised accustomed readers of The Informer. For once he was not amused and tolerant, though he never said anything worse of the Jeffersonian party than that it was ahead of its times. In both editorials and news stories he went after Buzz Windrip and his gang with whips, turpentine, and scandal. In person, he was into and out of shops and houses all morning long, arguing with voters, getting miniature interviews. He had expected that traditionally Republican Vermont would give him too drearily easy a task in preaching Trowbridge. What he found was a dismaying preference for the theoretically Democratic Buzz Windrip, and that preference, Doremus perceived, wasn't even a pathetic trust in Windrip's promises of utopian bliss for everyone in general. It was a trust in increased cash for the voter himself, and for his family very much in particular. Most of them had, among all the factors in the campaign, noticed only what they regarded as Windrip's humor, and three planks in his platform. 5, which promised to increase taxes on the rich, 10, which condemned the Negroes, since nothing so elevates a dispossessed farmer or a factory worker on relief as to have some race, any race, on which he can look down, and especially 11, which announced, or seemed to announce, that the average toiler would immediately receive $5,000 a year. And ever so many railway station debaters explained that it would really be $10,000. Why, they were going to have every cent offered by Dr. Townsend, plus everything planned by the late Huey Long, Upton Sinclair, and the Utopians all put together. So beatifically did hundreds of old people in Beulah Valley believe this that they smilingly trotted into Raymond Pridewell's hardware store to order new kitchen stoves and aluminum saucepans and complete bathroom furnishings to be paid for on the day after inauguration. Mr. Pridewell, a cobwebbed old Henry Cabot Lodge Republican, lost half his trade by chasing out these happy heirs to fabulous estates, but they went on dreaming, and Doremus, nagging at them, discovered that mere figures are defenseless against a dream. Even a dream of new Plymouths and unlimited cans of sausages and motion picture cameras, and the prospect of never having to arise till 7:30 a.m. Thus answered Alfred Tisra, Snake Tisra, friend to Doremus's handyman, Shad Ledoux. Snake was a steel-tough truck driver and taxi owner who had served sentences for assault and for transporting bootleg liquor. He had once made a living catching rattlesnakes and copperheads in southern New England. Under President Windrip, Snake jeeringly assured Doremus, he would have enough money to start a chain of roadhouses in all the dry communities in Vermont. Ed Howland, one of the lesser Fort Beulah grocers, and Charlie Betts, furniture and undertaking, while they were dead against anyone getting groceries, furniture, or even undertaking on Windrip credit, were all for the populations having credit on other wares. Heiress Dilly, a squatter dairy farmer living with a toothless wife and 7 slattern children in a tilted and unscrubbed cabin way up on Mount Terror, snarled at Doremus, who had often taken food baskets and boxes of shotgun shells and masses of cigarettes to Heiress.
"Well, want to tell you, when Mr. Windrip gets in, we farmers are going to fix our own prices on our crops, and not you smart city fellows."
Doremus could not blame him. While Buck Titus, at 50, looked 30-odd, Heiress, at 34, looked 50. Lorinda Pike's singularly unpleasant partner in the Beulah Valley Tavern, one Mr. Nipper, whom she hoped soon to lose, combined boasting how rich he was with gloating how much more he was going to get under Windrip. Professor Staubmeyer quoted nice things Windrip had said about higher pay for teachers. Lewis Roten Stern, to prove that his heart, at least, was not Jewish, became more lyric than any of them. And even Frank Tasbro of the Quarries, Maderi Cole of the Grist Mill and Real Estate Holdings, R.C. Crowley of the Bank, who presumably were not tickled by projects of higher income taxes, smiled pussycattishly and hinted that Windrip was a lot sounder fellow than people knew. But no one in Fort Beulah was a more active crusader for Buzz Windrip than Shad Ledoux. Doremus had known that Shad possessed talent for argument and for display, that he had once persuaded old Mr. Pridewell to trust him for a .22 rifle, value $23, that, removed from the sphere of coal bins and grass-stained overalls, he had once sung Rollicky Bill the Sailor at a smoker of the ancient and independent Order of Rams, and that he had enough memory to be able to quote, as his own profound opinions, the editorials in the Hearst newspapers. Yet even knowing all this equipment for a political career, an equipment not much short of Buzz Windrip's, Doremus was surprised to find Shad soapboxing for Windrip among the quarry workers, then actually as chairman of a rally in Oddfellows Hall. Shad spoke little but with brutal taunting of the believers in Trowbridge and Roosevelt. At meetings where he did not speak, Shad was an incomparable bouncer, and in that valued capacity he was summoned to Windrip rallies as far away as Burlington. It was he who, in a militia uniform, handsomely riding a large white plow horse, led the final Windrip parade in Rutland, and substantial men of affairs, even dry goods jobbers, fondly called him Shad. Doremus was amazed, felt a little apologetic over his failure to have appreciated this newfound paragon, as he sat in American Legion Hall and heard Shad bellowing,
"I don't pretend to be anything but a plain working stiff, but there's 40 million workers like me, and we know that Senator Windrip is the first statesman in years that thinks of what guys like us need before he thinks one doggone thing about politics. Come on, you bozos. The swell folks tell you to not be selfish. Walt Trowbridge tells you to not be selfish. Well, be selfish, and vote for the one man that's willing to give you something, give you something, and not just grab off every cent and every hour of work that he can get."
Doremus groaned inwardly. "Oh, my Shad, and you're doing most of this on my time." Sissy Jessup sat on the running board of her coop, hers by squatter's right, with Julian Falk, up from Amherst for the weekend, and Malcolm Tasbro wedged in on either side of her.
"Oh, nuts, let's quit talking politics. Windrip's going to be elected, so why waste time yodeling when we could drive down to the river and have a swim?" complained Malcolm.
"He's not going to win without our putting up a tough scrap against him. I'm going to talk to the high school alumni this evening about how they got to tell their parents to vote for either Trowbridge or Roosevelt," snapped Julian Falk.
"Ha, ha, ha. And of course the parents will be tickled to death to do whatever you tell them, Julian. You college men certainly are the goods. Besides, want to be serious about this fool business?"
Malcolm had the insolent self-assurance of beef, slick black hair, and a large car of his own,
He was the perfect leader of Blackshirts, and he looked contemptuously on Julian, who, though a year older, was pale and thinnish.
"Matter of fact, it'll be a good thing to have Buzz. He'll put a damn quick stop to all this radicalism, all this free speech and libel of our most fundamental institutions."
"Boston American, last Tuesday, page 8," murmured Sissy.
"And no wonder you're scared of him, Julian. He sure will drag some of your favorite Amherst anarchist profs off to the hoosegow. And maybe you too, comrade."
The two young men looked at each other with slow fury. Sissy quieted them by raging, "For heaven's sake, will you two heels quit scrapping? Oh, my dears, this beastly election, beastly! Seems as if it's breaking up every town, every home. My poor dad, Doremus, is just about all in."
Chapter 12
"I shall not be content till this country can produce every single thing we need, even coffee, cocoa, and rubber, and so keep all our dollars at home. If we can do this and at the same time work up tourist traffic so that foreigners will come from every part of the world to see such remarkable wonders as the Grand Canyon, Glacier and Yellowstone, etc., parks, the fine hotels of Chicago, and etc., thus leaving their money here, we shall have such a balance of trade as will go far to carry out my often criticized yet completely sound idea of from $3,000 to $5,000 per year for every single family. That is, I mean, every real American family. Such an aspiring vision is what we want, and not all of this nonsense of wasting our time at Geneva and talky-talk at Lugano, wherever that is."
0 hour, Berzelius Windrip.
Election day would fall on Tuesday, November 3rd, and on Sunday evening of the 1st, Senator Windrip played the finale of his campaign at a mass meeting in Madison Square Garden in New York. The garden would hold, with seats and standing room, about 19,000, and a week before the meeting every ticket had been sold, at from 50 cents to $5, and then, by speculators, resold and resold at from $1 to 20. Doremus had been able to get one single ticket from an acquaintance on one of the Hearst dailies, which alone among the New York papers were supporting Windrip. And on the afternoon of November 1st, he traveled the 300 miles to New York for his first visit in 3 years. It had been cold in Vermont with early snow, but the white drifts lay to the earth so quietly, in unstained air, that the world seemed a silver-painted carnival left to silence. Even on a moonless night, a pale radiance came from the snow, from the earth itself, and the stars were drops of quicksilver. But following the red cap carrying his shabby Gladstone bag, Doremus came out of the Grand Central at 6 o'clock into a gray trickle of cold dishwater from heaven's kitchen sink. The renowned towers which he expected to see on 42nd Street were dead in their mummy cloths of ragged fog. And as to the mob that, with cruel disinterest, galloped past him, a new and heedless smear of faces every second, the man from Fort Beulah could think only that New York must be holding its county fair in this clammy drizzle, or else that there was a big fire somewhere. He had sensibly planned to save money by using the subway, the substantial village burger is so poor in the city of the Babylonian Gardens, and he even remembered that there were still to be found in Manhattan 5-cent trolley cars, in which a rustic might divert himself by looking at sailors and poets and shawled women from the steppes of Kazakhstan. To the red cap he had piped with what he conceived to be traveled urbanity, "Guess I'll take a trolley, just few blocks." But deafened and dizzied and elbow-jabbed by the crowd, soaked and depressed, he took refuge in a taxi, then wished he hadn't, as he saw the slippery rubber-colored pavement,
and as his taxi got wedged among other cars, stinking of carbon monoxide and frenziedly tooting for release from the jam, a huddle of robot sheep bleating their terror with mechanical lungs of 100 horsepower. He painfully hesitated before going out again from his small hotel in the West 40s, and when he did, when he muddily crept among the shrill shop girls, the weary chorus girls, the hard cigar-clamping gamblers, and the pretty young men on Broadway, he felt himself, with the rubbers and umbrella which Emma had forced upon him, a very Casper Milquetoast. He most noticed a number of stray imitation soldiers, without sidearms or rifles, but in a uniform like that of an American cavalryman in 1870. Slant-topped blue forage caps, dark blue tunics, light blue trousers with yellow stripes at the seam, tucked into leggings of black rubberoid for what appeared to be the privates, and boots of sleek black leather for officers. Each of them had on the right side of his collar the letters M.M., and on the left a five-pointed star. There were so many of them. They swaggered so brazenly, shouldering civilians out of the way, and upon insignificances like Doremus they looked with frigid insolence. He suddenly understood. These young condottieri were the Minutemen, the private troops of Berzelius Windrip, about which Doremus had been publishing uneasy news reports. He was thrilled and a little dismayed to see them now. The printed words made brutal flesh. 3 weeks ago, Windrip had announced that Colonel Dewey Hake had founded, just for the campaign, a nationwide league of Windrip marching clubs, to be called the Minutemen. It was probable that they had been in formation for months, since already they had 300,000 or 400,000 members. Doremus was afraid the MMs might become a permanent organization, more menacing than the Ku Klux Klan. Their uniform suggested the pioneer America of Cold Harbor and of the Indian fighters under Miles and Custer. Their emblem, their swastika, here Doremus saw the cunning and mysticism of Lee Saracen, was a five-pointed star, because the star on the American flag was five-pointed, whereas the stars of both the Soviet banner and the Jews, the Seal of Solomon, were six-pointed. The fact that the Soviet star actually was also five-pointed, no one noticed during these excited days of regeneration. Anyway, it was a nice idea to have this star simultaneously challenge the Jews and the Bolsheviks. The MMs had good intentions, even if their symbolism did slip a little. Yet the craftiest thing about the MMs was that they wore no colored shirts, but only plain white when on parade, and light khaki when on outpost duty, so that Buzz Windrip could thunder and frequently, "Black shirts? Brown shirts? Red shirts? Yes, and maybe cow brindle shirts? All these degenerate European uniforms of tyranny. No, sir. The Minutemen are not fascist or communist or anything at all, but plain democratic, the knight champions of the rights of the forgotten men, the shock troops of freedom." Doremus dined on Chinese food, his invariable self-indulgence when he was in a large city without Emma, who stated that chow mein was nothing but fried excelsior with flour-paste gravy. He forgot the leering MM troopers a little. He was happy in glancing at the gilded wood carvings, at the octagonal lanterns painted with doll-like Chinese peasants crossing arched bridges, at a quartet of guests, two male and two female, who looked like public enemies and who all through dinner quarreled with restrained viciousness. When he headed toward Madison Square Garden and the culminating Windrip rally, he was plunged into a maelstrom. A whole nation seemed querulously to be headed the same way. He could not get a taxicab, and walking through the dreary storm some 14 blocks to Madison Square Garden, he was aware of the murderous temper of the crowd. 8th Avenue, lined with cheapjack shops, was packed with drab, discouraged people who yet, tonight, were tipsy with the hashish of hope.
They filled the sidewalks, nearly filled the pavement, while irritable motors squeezed tediously through them, and angry policemen were pushed and whirled about and, if they tried to be haughty, got jeered at by lively shop girls. Through the welter, before Doremus's eyes, jabbed a flying wedge of Minutemen, led by what he was later to recognize as a cornet of M.M.'s. They were not on duty, and they were not belligerent. They were cheering and singing Berzelius Windrip Went to Wash, reminding Doremus of a slightly drunken knot of students from an inferior college after a football victory. He was to remember them so afterward, months afterward, when the enemies of the M.M.'s all through the country derisively called them Mickey Mouses and Minnies. An old man, shabbily neat, stood blocking them and yelled, "To hell with Buzz! Three cheers for F.D.R.!" The M.M.'s burst into hoodlum wrath. The cornet in command, a bruiser uglier even than Shad Ledoux, hit the old man on the jaw, and he sloped down sickeningly. Then, from nowhere, facing the cornet, there was a chief petty officer of the Navy, big, smiling, reckless. The CPO bellowed in a voice tuned to hurricanes, "Swell bunch of tin soldiers! 9 of you to 1 grandpappy, just about even!" The cornet socked him. He laid out the cornet with one foul to the belly. Instantly, the other 8 MMs were on the CPO, like sparrows after a hawk, and he crashed, his face suddenly veal-white, laced with rivulets of blood. The 8 kicked him in the head with their thick marching shoes. They were still kicking him when Doremus wriggled away, very sick, altogether helpless. He had not turned away quickly enough to avoid seeing an M.M. trooper, girlish-faced, crimson-lipped, fawn-eyed, throw himself on the fallen cornet and, whimpering, stroke that roustabout's roast-beef cheeks with shy gardenia-petal fingers. There were many arguments, a few private fist-fights, and one more battle before Doremus reached the auditorium. A block from it, some 30 MMs, headed by a battalion leader, something between a captain and a major, started raiding a street meeting of communists. A Jewish girl in khaki, her bare head soaked with rain, was beseeching from the elevation of a wheelbarrow, "Fellow travelers, don't just chew the rag and sympathize. Join us, now. It's life and death." 20 feet from the communists, a middle-aged man who looked like a social worker was explaining the Jeffersonian Party, recalling the record of President Roosevelt, and reviling the communists next door as word-drunk un-American cranks. Half his audience were people who might be competent voters. Half of them, like half of any group on this evening of tragic fiesta, were cigarette-sniping boys in hand-me-downs. The 30 MMs cheerfully smashed into the communists. The battalion leader reached up, slapped the girl speaker, dragged her down from the wheelbarrow. His followers casually waded in with fists and blackjacks. Doremus, more nauseated, feeling more helpless than ever, heard the smack of a blackjack on the temple of a scrawny Jewish intellectual. Amazingly, then, the voice of the rival Jeffersonian leader spiraled up into a scream. "Come on, you! Going to let those hellhounds attack our communist friends? Friends now, by God!" With which the mild bookworm leaped into the air, came down squarely upon a fat Mickey Mouse, capsized him, seized his blackjack, took time to kick another M.M.'s shins before arising from the wreck, sprang up and waded into the raiders as, Doremus guessed, he would have waded into a table of statistics on the proportion of butterfat in loose milk in 97.7% of shops on Avenue B. Till then, only half a dozen Communist Party members had been facing the MMs, their backs to a garage wall. 50 of their own, 50 Jeffersonians besides, now joined them, and with bricks and umbrellas and deadly volumes of sociology, they drove off the enraged MMs, partisans of Bella Kuhn side by side with the partisans of Professor John Dewey, until a riot squad of policemen battered their way in to protect the MMs by arresting the girl communist speaker and the Jeffersonian. Doremus had often headed up sports stories about Madison Square Garden prize fights, but he did know that the place had nothing to do with Madison Square, from which it was a day's journey by bus, that it was decidedly not a garden, that the fighters there did not fight for prizes, but for fixed partnership shares in the business, and that a good many of them did not fight at all. The mammoth building, as in exhaustion Doremus crawled up to it, was entirely ringed with MMs, elbow to elbow, all carrying heavy canes, and at every entrance, along every aisle, the MMs were rigidly in line, with their officers galloping about, whispering orders, and bearing uneasy rumors like scared calves in a dipping pen. These past weeks, hungry miners, dispossessed farmers, Carolina mill hands had greeted Senator Windrip with a flutter of worn hands beneath gasoline torches. Now he was to face not the unemployed, for they could not afford 50-cent tickets, but the small, scared side-street traders of New York, who considered themselves altogether superior to clodhoppers and mine creepers, yet were as desperate as they. The swelling mass that Doremus saw, proud in seats or standing chin to nape in the aisles, in a reek of dampened clothes, was not romantic. They were people concerned with the tailor's goose, the tray of potato salad, the card of hooks and eyes, the leech-like mortgage on the owner-driven taxi, with, at home, the baby's diapers, the dull safety razor blade, the awful rise in the cost of rump steak and kosher chicken. And a few, and very proud, civil service clerks and letter carriers and superintendents of small apartment houses, curiously fashionable in $17 ready-made suits and feebly stitched foulard ties, who boasted, "I don't know why all these bums go on relief. I may not be such a whiz, but let me tell you, even since 1929, I've never made less than $2,000 a year." Manhattan peasants. Kind people, industrious people, generous to their aged, eager to find any desperate cure for the sickness of worry over losing the job. Most facile material for any rabble-rouser. The historic rally opened with extreme dullness. A regimental band played the Tales from Hoffman barcarolle with no apparent significance and not much more liveliness. The Reverend Dr. Hendrik van Lollop of St. Apollog's Lutheran Church offered prayer, but one felt that probably it had not been accepted. Senator Porkwood provided a dissertation on Senator Windrip, which was composed in equal parts of apostolic adoration of Buzz and of the uh-uh-uhs with which Honorable Porkwood always interspersed his words. And Windrip wasn't yet even in sight. Colonel Dewey Hake, nominator of Buzz at the Cleveland Convention, was considerably better. He told three jokes and an anecdote about a faithful carrier pigeon in the Great War which had seemed to understand, really better than many of the human soldiers, just why it was that the Americans were over there fighting for France against Germany. The connection of this ornithological hero with the virtues of Senator Windrip did not seem evident, but after having sat under Senator Porkwood, the audience enjoyed the note of military gallantry. Doremus felt that Colonel Hake was not merely rambling, but pounding on toward something definite. His voice became more insistent. He began to talk about Windrip. "My friend, the one man who dares beard the monetary lion. The man who in his great and simple heart cherishes the woe of every common man as once did the brooding tenderness of Abraham Lincoln." Then, wildly waving toward a side entrance, he shrieked, "And here he comes, my friends, Buzz Windrip!" The band hammered out, "The Campbells are coming." A squadron of minutemen, smart as horse guards, carrying long lances with starred pennants, clicked into the gigantic bowl of the auditorium, and after them, shabby in an old blue serge suit, nervously twisting a sweat-stained slouch hat, stooped and tired, limped Berzelius Windrip. The audience leaped up, thrusting one another aside to have a look at the deliverer, cheering like artillery at dawn. Windrip started prosaically enough. You felt rather sorry for him, so awkwardly did he lumber up the steps to the platform, across to the center of the stage. He stopped, stared owlishly, then he quacked monotonously.
"The first time I ever came to New York, I was a greenhorn. No, don't laugh, maybe I still am. But I'd already been elected a United States Senator, and back home, the way they'd serenaded me, I thought I was some punkins. I thought my name was just about as familiar to everybody as Al Capone's, or Camel Cigarettes, or Castoria. Babies cry for it. But I come to New York on my way to Washington, and say, I sat in my hotel lobby here for 3 days, and the only fella ever spoke to me was the hotel detective. And when he did come up and address me, I was tickled to death. I thought he was going to tell me the whole burg was pleased by my condescending to visit him. But all he wanted to know was I a guest of the hotel, and did I have any right to be holding down a lobby chair permanently that way? And tonight, friends, I'm pretty near as scared of old Gotham as I was then. The laughter, the hand-clapping were fair enough, but the proud electors were disappointed by his drawl, his weary humility. Doremus quivered hopefully. Maybe he isn't going to get elected. Windrip outlined his too familiar platform. Doremus was interested only in observing that Windrip misquoted his own figures regarding the limitation of fortunes in point 5. He slid into a rhapsody of general ideas, a mishmash of polite regards to justice, freedom, equality, order, prosperity, patriotism, and any number of other noble but slippery abstractions. Doremus thought he was being bored, until he discovered that at some moment which he had not noticed, he had become absorbed and excited. Something in the intensity with which Windrip looked at his audience, looked at all of them, his glance slowly taking them in from the highest perched seat to the nearest, convinced them that he was talking to each individual, directly and solely, that he wanted to take each of them into his heart, that he was telling them the truths, the imperious and dangerous facts that had been hidden from them. "They say I want money, power. Say I've turned down offers from law firms right here in New York of 3 times the money I'll get as president. And power? Why, the president is the servant of every citizen in the country, and not just of the considerate folks, but also of every crank that comes pestering him by telegram and phone and letter. And yet it's true. It's absolutely true. I do want power. Great, big, imperial power. But not for myself. No, for you. The power of your permission to smash the Jew financiers who've enslaved you, who are working you to death to pay the interest on their bonds. The grasping bankers, and not all of them Jews by a darn sight. The crooked labor leaders just as much as the crooked bosses. And most of all, the sneaking spies of Moscow that want you to lick the boots of their self-appointed tyrants that rule not by love and loyalty, like I want to, but by the horrible power of the whip, the dark cell, the automatic pistol."
He pictured then a paradise of democracy in which, with the old political machines destroyed, every humblest worker would be king and ruler, dominating representatives elected from among his own kind of people. And these representatives not growing indifferent, as hitherto they had done once they were far off in Washington, but kept alert to the public interest by the supervision of a strengthened executive. It sounded almost reasonable, for a while. The supreme actor, Buzz Windrip, was passionate, yet never grotesquely wild. He did not gesture too extravagantly. Only, like Gene Debs of old, he reached out a bony forefinger which seemed to jab into each of them and hook out each heart. It was his mad eyes, big, staring, tragic eyes, that startled them, and his voice, now thundering, now humbly pleading, that soothed them. He was so obviously an honest and merciful leader, a man of sorrows and acquaint with woe. Doremus marveled, "I'll be hanged. Why, he's a darn good sort when you come to meet him, and warm-hearted. He makes me feel as if I'd been having a good evening with Buck and Steve Perifix. What if Buzz is right? What if, in spite of all the demagogic pap that I suppose he has got to feed out to the boobs, he's right in claiming that it's only he and not Trowbridge or Roosevelt that can break the hold of the absentee owners? And these Minutemen, his followers, oh, they were pretty nasty, what I saw out on the street, but still, most of 'em are mighty nice, clean-cut young fellows. Seeing Buzz and then listening to what he actually says does kind of surprise you, kind of make you think." But what Mr. Windrip actually had said, Doremus could not remember an hour later, when he had come out of the trance. He was so convinced then that Windrip would win that on Tuesday evening he did not remain at the Informer office until the returns were all in. But if he did not stay for the evidences of the election, they came to him. Past his house after midnight, through muddy snow, tramped a triumphant and reasonably drunken parade, carrying torches and bellowing to the air of Yankee Doodle, new words revealed just that week by Mrs. Adelaide Targimich. "The snake's disloyal to our Buzz, we're riding on a rail. They'll wish to God they never was when we get them in jail." Chorus. "Buzz and Buzz and keep it up, to victory he's floated. You were a most ungrateful pup, unless for Buzz you voted. Every M.M. gets a whip to use upon some traitor, and every anti-Buzz we skip today, we'll tend to later." Anti-Buzz, a word credited to Mrs. Gimmich, but more probably invented by Dr. Hector McGoblin, was to be extensively used by lady patriots as a term expressing such vicious disloyalty to the state as might call for the firing squad. Yet, like Mrs. Gimmich's splendid synthesis Unkies for soldiers of the AEF, it never really caught on. Among the winter-coated paraders, Doremus and Sissy thought they could make out Shad Ledoux, Eris Dilly, that philoprogenitive squatter from Mount Terror, Charlie Betts, the furniture dealer, and Tony Mogliani, the fruit seller, most ardent expounder of Italian fascism in central Vermont. And though he could not be sure of it in the dimness behind the torches, Doremus rather thought that the lone large motor car following the procession was that of his neighbor, Francis Tasbro. Next morning, at the Informer office, Doremus did not learn of so very much damage wrought by the triumphant Nordics. They had merely upset a couple of privies, torn down and burned the tailor shop sign of Louis Rotenstern, and somewhat badly beaten Clifford Little, the jeweler, a slight curly-headed young man whom Shad Ledoux despised because he organized theatricals and played the organ in Mr. Falk's church. That night, Doremus found on his front porch a notice in red chalk upon butcher's paper. "You will get yours, Dory sweetheart, unless you get right down on your belly and crawl in front of the M.M. and the League and the Chief and I. A friend." It was the first time that Doremus had heard of the Chief, a sound American variant of the leader or the head of the government, as a popular title for Mr. Windrip. It was soon to be made official. Doremus burned the red warning without telling his family, but he often woke to remember it, not very laughingly. Chapter 13. "And when I get ready to retire, I'm going to build me an up-to-date bungalow in some lovely resort, not in Como or any other of the proverbial Grecian Isles, you may be sure, but in somewheres like Florida, California, Santa Fe, and etc., and devote myself just to reading the classics, like Longfellow, James Whitcomb Riley, Lord Macaulay, Henry Van Dyke, Elbert Hubbard, Plato, Hiawatha, and etc. Some of my friends laugh at me for it, but I have always cultivated a taste for the finest in literature.
I got it from my mother, as I did everything that some people have been so good as to admire in me. Zero Hour, Berzelius Windrip. Certain though Doremus had been of Windrip's election, the event was like the long-dreaded passing of a friend. All right, hell with this country if it's like that. All these years I've worked, and I never did want to be on all these committees and boards and charity drives. And don't they look silly now? What I always wanted to do was to sneak off to an ivory tower, or anyway, celluloid imitation ivory, and read everything I've been too busy to read. Thus Doremus in late November. And he did actually attempt it, and for a few days reveled in it, avoiding everyone save his family and Lorinda, Buck Titus, and Father Perifix. Mostly, though, he found that he did not relish the classics he had so far missed, but those familiar to his youth. Ivanhoe, Huckleberry Finn, Midsummer Night's Dream, The Tempest, L'Allegro, The Way of All Flesh, not quite so youthful there, Moby Dick, The Earthly Paradise, St. Agnes's Eve, The Idylls of the King, most of Swinburne, Pride and Prejudice, Religio Medici, Vanity Fair. Probably he was not so very different from President-elect Windrip in his rather uncritical reverence toward any book he had heard of before he was 30. No American whose fathers have lived in the country for over 2 generations is so utterly different from any other American. In one thing, Doremus's literary escapism failed him thoroughly. He tried to relearn Latin, but he could not now, uncajoled by a master, believe that mensa, mensae, mensae, mensam, mensa, all that idiotic a table, of a table, to a table, toward a table, at, in, by, or on a table, could bear him again as once it had to the honey-sweet tranquility of Virgil and the Sabine farm. Then he saw that in everything his quest failed him. The reading was good enough, toothsome, satisfying, except that he felt guilty at having sneaked away to an ivory tower at all. Too many years he had made a habit of social duty. He wanted to be in things, and he was daily more irritable as Windrip began, even before his inauguration, to dictate to the country. Buzz's party, with the desertions to the Jeffersonians, had less than a majority in Congress. Inside dope came to Doremus from Washington that Windrip was trying to buy, to flatter, to blackmail opposing congressmen. A president-elect has unhallowed power if he so wishes, and Windrip, no doubt with promises of abnormal favors in the way of patronage, won over a few. 5 Jeffersonian congressmen had their elections challenged. 1 sensationally disappeared, and smoking after his galloping heels there was a devilish fume of embezzlements. And with each such triumph of Windrip, all the well-meaning, cloistered Doremuses of the country were the more anxious. All through the Depression, ever since 1929, Doremus had felt the insecurity, the confusion, the sense of futility in trying to do anything more permanent than shaving or eating breakfast that was general to the country. He could no longer plan for himself or for his dependents, as the citizens of this once unsettled country had planned since 1620. Why, their whole lives had been predicated on the privilege of planning. Depressions had been only cyclic storms, certain to end in sunshine. Capitalism and parliamentary government were eternal, and eternally being improved by the honest votes of good citizens. Doremus's grandfather, Calvin, Civil War veteran and ill-paid, illiberal congregational minister, had yet planned, "My son Lauren shall have a theological education, and I think we shall be able to build a fine new house in 15 or 20 years." That had given him a reason for working and a goal. His father, Lauren, had vowed, "Even if I have to economize on books a little, and perhaps give up this extravagance of eating meat 4 times a week,
Very bad for the digestion, anyway. My son Doremus shall have a college education, and when, as he desires, he becomes a publicist, I think perhaps I shall be able to help him for a year or two. And then I hope, oh, in a mere 5 or 6 years more, to buy that complete Dickens with all the illustrations. Oh, an extravagance, but a thing to leave to my grandchildren to treasure forever."